From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll hear how Milwaukee's chairman of the Republican Party is trying to sway voters in a Democratic stronghold. Then, we'll speak with someone from the National Museum of African American Music about Black Music Month.
The purpose of Black Music Month is that we, Black people, Black artists, Black musicians, we are a part of this American soundtrack.
Plus, Wandering Wisconsin recognizes June Dairy Month and helps you plan a trip that'll grow your knowledge about the state's agriculture.
The dairy industry is such a big contributor to our state's economy. We are still home to over a million cows, and our cheesemakers regularly win more awards than any other state or even any country.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. There's a place in Wisconsin where you can go to learn all about where your locally produced dairy comes from. That's everything from the birth of a calf to how your milk ends up in the grocery store. We'll tell you about that in Wandering Wisconsin later in the show. We'll start with this. Wisconsin is a key swing state in this year's presidential election. Some Republicans think to win the state, the GOP needs to make inroads with Milwaukee voters. It's the largest and most racially diverse county in the state, and it's heavily Democratic. WUWM's Mayon Silver speaks to a young Republican organizer who's trying to do just that.
At a Cinco de Mayo event last month in Milwaukee, celebrating Mexico's victory in the Battle of Pueblo in 1862, people walk by with little dogs, eating tortas or plucking away at styrofoam containers of elote corn. Children shriek with delight as they slide down amusement park rides. It may just be the perfect place to engage people about politics, says Hilario De Leon. He's the chair of the Republican Party of Milwaukee County. He's standing at a table draped in red with a Trump sign leaning against it, front and center.
How you doing, folks? How you doing? What's wrong? Let's have a conversation. No?
Or maybe not. The 23-year-old has dubbed his approach Operation Connecting Milwaukee. He says he's using data to engage people with a conservative platform.
Because for a long time, Republicans have kind of left it alone and thought it's a lost cause. Well, now they're starting to wake up and realize that if you lose by less in cities like Milwaukee, you can take the rest of the state because the rest of the state will carry for President Trump.
In 2020, around 70% of Milwaukee's vote went to Joe Biden. De Leon, who's Hispanic, thinks outreach at events like these can make inroads for former President Donald Trump among Latino voters. With Operation Connecting Milwaukee, De Leon is trying to dig up people who may lean conservative but not vote often, and also connect with independents, libertarians, and disaffected liberals. De Leon is occasionally interrupted as he tells me about how his political views developed in high school when Trump was in office.
I was the only Republican in the entire school, and I was, hey, how's it going? Hey! I was treated horribly in the school. By students and teachers. So it really made me want to pay attention more to every single issue that he got done when he was president.
The Trump sign leaning against the red table at the GOP engagement booth keeps getting blown over by the wind. Each time, De Leon dutifully picks it back up again. It's a tenacity he's had even since he was a kid. When he was in first grade, he found a set of Civil War books in a closet in his house.
And I would stay up late at night and I would flip through it and I saw and studied the history of the war and how we got where we were. I'm a Civil War reenactor myself.
De Leon says he was inspired by Republican abolitionists at the time, like Abraham Lincoln.
We were one of the only countries that fought a war against ourselves to free our fellow man.
De Leon was adopted. His biological dad is from Mexico, but he's quick to point out that he's American and Hispanic.
If you would break it down by ethnicity, I have Mexican, Spanish, German, Polish, Mr. Worldwide, as one person might put it.
Some Hispanic groups have torn into Trump for his attacks on immigrants. He said immigrants who commit crimes are animals and, quote, poisoning the blood of this country. Trump also boasts that he'll get Mexico to pay for a border wall. But there is nothing about Trump that gives De Leon pause.
Let Trump be Trump. Let him be him. He does what he does. You can take the man out of New York, but you can't take New York out of the man.
A festival goer wearing a Mexican cowboy hat approaches the GOP booth. His name is Tony Garnica, and he's ready to talk about Trump.
You know Trump is against immigrants?
100%. No, that's not true. 100%. He says he's not 100%. He has said many times that I want people to come in legally.
I know, but he says as soon as he gets in power, he's going to kick everybody out, all the immigrants.
That's not what he means.
At various events this year, Trump pledged the largest deportation in the history of our country. But De Leon says that didn't happen in Trump's previous term and claims Trump only wants to deport criminals. Garnica and De Leon continue to debate about Trump's character and policies.
As soon as he gets in power, he's going to send every illegal in this country out of this.
100% wrong on that. That is not going to happen.
And when it doesn't happen... Who's going to kick out? All the Mexicans.
De Leon interjects that he's part Hispanic himself. And Garnica says he's talking about undocumented Mexicans. That prompts a question from De Leon.
Are you
Mexico? No.
Then what are you worried about?
All the illegal... Of course, I'm worried about my people. What do you mean, what I worry about?
You're a citizen, right? You're an American, right?
Yeah.
What about the American people?
Garnica is exactly the demographic De Leon is looking for. He's Hispanic and says he leans conservative. But this year, Garnica says he'll be voting for Biden. The interaction shows the challenge De Leon faces as he tries to persuade Milwaukeeans to the Republican side. But he doesn't have to win everybody over. Just enough to push up Trump's ceiling in Milwaukee. In this state, every vote counts.
By showing up to places like this, events like this, it's how we lose by less. We make a presence, we show that we're here in the community, because a lot of times people say that Republicans aren't in the community. Well, they can't say that anymore because we're here. I'm here as the chairman, as the leader. I have plenty of other people that could be here, but I choose to be here myself. How you doing, ladies?
On the other side of the festival grounds, two paleta sellers, hawking the creamy and fruity Mexican popsicles, ring dueling bells as they compete for customers. De Leon is competing in a way too, for voters, and he's all right with that. Maya Ann Silver, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Hilario De Leon is the chairman of the Republican Party of Milwaukee. He spoke with WUWM's Maya Ann Silver. If you want to learn more about Wisconsin's role as an important swing state, check out WUWM's podcast, Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the RNC, and you can find it wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. Black Music Month began on June 7, 1979. It was the day President Jimmy Carter officially recognized the month with a celebration on the White House lawn. The annual celebration commemorates the impact that black music has in the United States and around the world. It was the culmination of efforts by the Black Music Association, which was formed 1 year earlier, that made the month a reality. The association's purpose was to preserve, protect, and perpetuate black music on an international basis. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell is joined by Noelle Taylor, Director of Education and Exhibitions at the National Museum of African American Music, to learn more about Black History Month.
There's this challenge going around social media in honor of Black Music Month where you get a new prompt every day of the month and post the song that aligns with said prompt. For example, a prompt might say, "This is the song where you wished you were in the music video." My prompt for you is, name a song that puts you in a celebratory mood.
You know what? I'm going to go with One Nation Under a Groove because that is definitely part of our logo, our mission. And with everything that is going on at the museum, Black Music Month related, over 17 programs for the month of June. We can't do it without each other. And so it's like that whole idea of one nation under a groove. It's the music that binds us together. It's the music that moves us forward. It's the music that connects us. And that's the music that's going to get us through the month and the days that are hard and the days that we need to celebrate.
I love that. Interestingly, I did not know that Black Music Month was an annual celebration, I think, until 2021. For other people out there who never heard of Black Music Month, what is that?
This is the 45th anniversary. We just had a celebration on June 7th on the actual birthday. And one of the founders, Deanna Williams, was present and got a chance to sit down and talk with her. You know, Deanna Williams, Kenny Gamble of Gamble and Tufts, and Ed Wright really started what is the Black Music Association based off what they saw in Nashville with the Country Music Association and seeing like, we need this type of support and recognition for Black artists in terms of musicianship, in terms of publishing, in terms of all of the things that are being created for other country artists. We want to bring that forward for Black artists. And so they actually started with the Black Music Association, which is approaching its 50th anniversary. And Deanna Williams has really been carrying that torch for the last 45 years. She's actually one of our board members. She's called the mother of Black Music Month. And just really, the first tagline was Black Music is Green. And it was about the capabilities of Black music and Black artists to really pour into the economy, to really pour into the culture. When you think about how Black music affects culture, genre bending, you know, we represent over 50 genres and subgenres in the museum. And all of that stems from the original Black music. And so this month is just dedicated to honoring and celebrating what is done 365 days a year, but really highlighting, okay, this is the month that we want to celebrate and bring attention and draw in and make people aware of Black Music Month. So yeah, it's 45 years strong. Right now our tagline is Soundmakers 45 years. And it's just a really beautiful expression of artistry and being able to honor so many current, past and future musicians who are paving the way and making Black music and culture what it is.
So you kind of mentioned, when we talk about Black music, like so many genres and subgenres that Black people have, you know, invented, curated, poured into, what are some of those genres? Because I feel like a lot of people don't know Black people, we have our hands in so many genres of music, right? We started so many genres. What are some of those?
Yeah, so every genre is I would be remiss if I did not point out that in some way, every genre that has developed through music stands on the shoulders of Black instruments, Black musicianship, Black lyrics. And so often in the museum, we don't, even our galleries are not named after genres. Right. So our first gallery that you go into is Wade in the Water. And if you know the reference, then you know that that is a gospel song. But we were very intentional in not naming the galleries after genres because there's an ebb and flow. There's a tension. There's a bend to what comes out of gospel music. I mean, now we have trap gospel. We have jazz gospel. We have all of these fusions. Right. Another gallery is Crossroads. You go in there, you immediately know that that is attributed to blues. But you, with that, you have folk, you have Americana. In that very gallery, you have one of the first instruments that transformed into a banjo over all of the hundreds of years that came from West Africa. You know, we have A Love Supreme. And anyone who knows the title of that song knows that that has something to do with jazz. But again, there are so many different ways and so many different possibilities that have come through music and just the way that Black artists hear and modify and change and the thought that like all of the messages are there. Quote, hip hop gallery, but you wouldn't get to the message at the end of the gallery if you hadn't started wading water. And the museum really does a phenomenal job of building the context and the narrative around this musical journey that we've all been on. One of the things that I like to say is our Rivers of Rhythm, which is our main spine of the gallery that the other galleries go off of. Toni Morrison has this quote when she talks about when the Mississippi River floods, initially they bent the river to do what it needs to do, but when it floods, it's just trying to find its way back home. And I think that's what we do at the museums, is finding the way back home and showing how far we've come.
Why is it important to know that Black folks have had this level of influence in music and really honor it every year? Like for the broader, you know, world, why is it important for us to know this history? Past, present, and future.
For sure. We would be remiss if we are not telling the story of Black music, period. And, you know, sometimes like through political, social aspects, especially in the South, there is this tendency to hide, skirt around, or not acknowledge truths that are part of our everyday life. And one of the things I tell people when they come in the museum is we don't generally do guided tours, and we don't do that specifically because every person who comes through the museum has a completely different experience. There's a connection that you make based on some song that you've heard. Maybe you've heard your grandmother or your mom play it. Maybe you have the updated sampled or covered version of that. You make those connections based on your experiences and the story that we are telling. And the purpose of Black Music Month, pointing us back to why we even have a museum, is that we, Black people, Black artists, Black musicians, we are a part of this American soundtrack. We started it. We have to be able to acknowledge, recognize, and celebrate that. And we hope and very much want people to understand that we're a fabric of the American soundtrack. Like, we are helping to weave it together. And you just can't have music without having us as part of the story. And so that is why Black Music Month, just to have that piece. The same thing with like Black History Month. We know it's not 1 month. We know that it's 365 days a year. It's every month of every year. But it just brings new people in who don't know the story. And then you begin asking questions, and then you begin learning more, and then you begin to see. And that's part of what we do as an institution.
When you think about the impact that Black music has had globally, how do you put that into words? If it just had to be like a quick sentence.
I'm stealing someone's words, and I want to make sure that he's credited, but in one sentence, Black music is uncatchable. And from genre, from the impact culturally, from the impact economically, even in the moments that we fight commodification, fight people taking our art and crediting it, the music it's uncatchable.
Noelle Taylor is the Director of Education and Exhibitions at the National Museum of African American Music. She spoke with WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a small town and its complicated history with how the atomic bombs were developed. But first, ever notice that big barn on the side of the highway in northern Wisconsin? We'll tell you all about it and how it can help connect you to the state's agriculture next on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Cheese is obviously a big deal here in Wisconsin. Custard, too. We can't forget about that. And it might be easy to take these dairy staples for granted, and June is the perfect time to learn more about where our favorite dairy products come from. It's National Dairy Month, and so for this month's Wandering Wisconsin, we'll tell you about a big red barn on the side of the highway just south of Manitowoc. It's the Farm Wisconsin Discovery Center. Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen is joined by its executive director, Patty Lane, and Amanda Weibel with Travel Wisconsin.
Patty and Amanda, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for joining me for another Wandering Wisconsin.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about Wisconsin's dairy industry. Patty, can you explain why dairy production is so significant in the state?
Oh, sure. The agriculture industry in Wisconsin is so significant to our economy, and it's really hard to draw a line around dairy specifically because there are so many ancillary industries that are related to dairy. So our agriculture industry in Wisconsin is a $104 billion industry. So it's very significant, and dairy is a significant portion of that.
And Amanda, we've talked in the past about agritourism and why people are becoming more interested in seeing where their food and other products come from. And it sounds like Farm Wisconsin Discovery Center is the perfect place to do that. So Patty, what can people learn on a visit to the center?
Well, they can learn about where their food comes from in a nutshell. We do that by having three different experiences for our visitors. We have 10,000 square feet of exhibits that deal with anything from dairy is certainly front and center when you get into our exhibit area. But we also talk about the diversity of agriculture in Wisconsin. Because our beautiful state is so diverse in its topography and soil and climate, different things grow better in various regions of the state. So that is another significant area. We talk about the environment and technology, as well as just the culture of agriculture and the careers that are associated. We also have a virtual farm tour of a local modern dairy farm. So that is wonderful to be able to travel through this farm, literally right through the barn and right up to the rotary parlor area where the cows get milked. And then what's really special, I like to call it the exclamation point to a visit, is our Land O'Lakes birthing barn. So we bring two pregnant cows from that farm that we do the farm tour through. And the hope is if, and I can't guarantee for obvious reasons that we're going to have a birth, but there's a little announcement that gets made to tell people that they can go experience the miracle of birth in the Land O'Lakes birthing barn. So we want to make sure anybody who's in the building has the opportunity to see that happen. Most days we have at least one birth in our Land O'Lakes birthing barn. So visitors are able to see that miracle happen right here.
Amazing. And there's a farmhouse store and a cafe as well.
Yeah, I'd like to say that kind of brings the farm-to-table story full circle. So you can either buy products in our store that are sourced here in Wisconsin. Of course, we've got plenty of Wisconsin cheese. And then our Wisconsin Cafe also features farm-to-table breakfast and lunch items.
And we've got Dairy Day coming up on June 22nd, and there's some special stuff going on at the center for that. So what can you tell me about Dairy Day?
We do special events. We average about one a month. So in June, our special event where we go deeper into the topic is dairy, of course. So we're having June Dairy Day on Saturday, June 22nd. So we have special activities that go above and beyond what our core activities are here in the Discovery Center on a daily basis. We'll be following from cow to carton, the path that milk takes, so that people, again, understand that milk doesn't just come out of the grocery store. It actually has a supply chain that it goes through. We'll have, of course, additional animals here on site. So one thing that has become very interesting to people with dietary issues is A2 milk. And so we will have an A2 sourced farm that will be bringing in their Jersey calf. It's a farm that produces A2 cheese. So learning more about that directly from the farmer is something that people can anticipate. Also have clipping demonstrations and a few other science-related activities. So it's a great day to come on to Farm Wisconsin.
And what is A2 milk?
A lot of times people think that they are allergic to milk or just have problems digesting. So A2 is a protein that is more easily digested. And so the cows are bred to have A2 instead of the other proteins that are more difficult to digest.
Interesting.
And I'm not a science major, so there's a much more technical description to that, but it is just much more palatable for people who otherwise can't enjoy some of the dairy products that we produce in our state.
Okay. So Amanda, if travelers maybe want to make a weekend out of their dairy day, what are some other things they could do while they're in the Manitowoc area?
Well, you are going to find activities that everyone in your travel party will enjoy in the Manitowoc area. Maybe you want to add a little arts and culture to your itinerary. Then the RAR West Art Museum is going to be your go-to stop. It's a free museum and it's set in this beautiful Victorian era mansion. And the museum's collection is so impressive. They have artwork from well-known names like Picasso, Georgia O'Keeffe, and even Andy Warhol. If you want to get outdoors and catch some cool breezes and Lake Michigan views, check out the Mariner's Trail. The trail winds along the shoreline for 6 miles, and it connects the cities of Manitowoc and Two Rivers. So you can walk, bike, jog, rollerblade the trail, however you want to go about it. But you're going to see some really fun artwork, beautiful flowers, and of course, great views of Lake Michigan along the way. And once you've made it to Two Rivers, you're going to want to head to Point Beach State Forest to see the historic Raleigh Point Lighthouse. It has been operated and maintained by the Coast Guard since 1853. And you can also explore 6 more miles of sandy beaches. And the State Forest even has a beach wheelchair available at no cost for folks with mobility issues to get to enjoy the sand as well.
So if people didn't fill up on goods from that farmhouse store, where are some places you'd recommend they check out to eat?
I recommend visiting the Courthouse Pub for some unexpected flavors. They infuse creativity into every dish, and they even cleverly name their meals off of the nearby courthouse. So instead of an appetizer, you're going to start your meal with one of the Courthouse Pub's opening statements, like the smoked salmon dip or cherry cola sliders. And for the main meal, maybe you'll go with a sandwich like their blackberry and brie burger or an entree, also known as small claims on their menu, like the coconut dusted chicken, which is served with a mango chili chutney. Another great dining spot in Manitowoc is The Wharf. It's a waterfront restaurant and music venue. They have this massive outdoor patio where you are going to make the most of those sweet summer moments. You'll be savoring your classic pub fare while enjoying live bands, and that happens every weekend through September.
Are there any interesting places to stay in the area?
In Two Rivers, you have a rare chance to spend the night in a Frank Lloyd Wright designed house. Still Bend is a gorgeous home designed by the famed Wisconsin architect. Because it is a very popular option, Still Bend is almost completely booked up for the summer season, so you might want to look into availability for the fall or winter. But they do offer public tours of the house in the summer to give you a glimpse of Frank Lloyd Wright's innovative designs. But another easier option to book a room for the summer would be the Village Inn on the Lake. It's right across the road from Lake Michigan. It's just south of Two Rivers. And you can either spend the weekend in one of their hotel rooms, maybe the Whirlpool Suites, or tow the camper along and stay in their RV park, where you're also going to enjoy on-site amenities like an 18-hole mini golf course and an indoor swimming pool.
So Dairy Month is celebrated nationally, but obviously dairy is a big deal here in Wisconsin. So for both of you, why would you encourage people to learn about the state's dairy industry?
I think it's really important for people to know about where their food comes from. And I'm of an age where when I was in school, a lot of us either had a family member or a good friend who, you know, we had the ability to go to a farm because we knew somebody with a farm. That is less and less the case now. And only 2% of our population is involved in food production. So it's really important to decrease our learning gap and come and just learn more about our food, but also because it's fun.
And Amanda?
As Patty mentioned, the dairy industry is such a big contributor to our state's economy. We are still home to over 1 million cows, and our cheesemakers regularly win more awards than any other state or even any country. But like Patty mentioned, that personal connection is so unique. I've mentioned to Becky before, I actually grew up on a dairy farm. My brother is a fifth generation to work on our family farm. So to me, that personal connection is really important. But even if you don't have a farming background, I just think it's so special how, like Patty mentioned, Wisconsin has so many ways to still connect people to and help you experience Wisconsin's dairy industry. You can go on a farm tour. You can find tasting events. You can visit the Farm Wisconsin Discovery Center like we've been discussing today. There are just so many fun and engaging ways to experience the dairy state.
The only other thing that I would mention, I hear all the time that people recognize our building. We're that big red barn along I-43 just south of Manitowoc. And people are constantly, oh, I have driven by that so many times and I've never stopped. And just this morning, I ran into a family who was saying that we have driven by here dozens and dozens of times, and we finally decided to come see what it's all about. So people are very, very familiar with the landmark of our building, and it's great for them to realize that they can come explore here.
I am one of those people. When Amanda suggested this segment, I was like, I totally know that building.
I have heard so many times, beautiful building. What is it? So it's like, oh, come explore.
I think I've said out loud driving by before, like, I wonder what that is. Like, I should check that out sometime.
I will actually confess that I have not been there either, which I'm very sad.
Oh my gosh. And Amanda, I'm so happy to hear that you're also a dairy farm girl.
Yeah, I am too.
I grew up in this county on a little 60 cow dairy farm.
My family farm was about 60 cows too. So yeah, exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I will be sure to, next time I won't just drive by. I'll stop in and check it out.
Please do.
Patty, Amanda, thank you both so much for joining me for Wandering Wisconsin.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate.
Patty Lane is the executive director of the Farm Wisconsin Discovery Center. Amanda Weibel is the communications officer for Travel Wisconsin. Like many barns in Wisconsin, the Farm Wisconsin Discovery Center is marked with a quilt. If you've driven through rural Wisconsin, chances are you've seen a barn quilt, and probably several. They're large, square paintings hung on barns and can depict anything from flowers to patterns or even barns themselves. Caitlin Curtis and Laura Mason are part of a team who mapped out these barn quilts, along with Kathy Wilson, the executive director of the Racine Arts Council. They joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain more.
What are the origins of these barn quilts?
Well, it's very interesting. When I first heard about barn quilts, it was in Grundy County, Iowa. And it was back in about 2006, I think. And my mother and I were both quilters and photographers. And we had a quilt magazine. And so we were looking at these pictures of quilt on the barns. And at that time, I think they were in Indiana and people would just use them for sort of designs on their barns. And it sort of started to take off. So my mother and I went to Grundy County, Iowa to see what these quilt patterns on the barns look like. And they were phenomenal. And being an artist and a photographer, all we wanted to do was jump out of the car and take a photograph.
As we look at the landscape of Wisconsin today, how common are these barn quilts?
Well, that's another interesting question. We were the first ones in the state to create a Quilts on Barns project. Once we started our project, then other counties next to us started putting quilt patterns on barns. They're up in Door County, and now they're all over the state. But Racine County was the first place to have them.
So Parkside has become involved in this barn quilt project. Can you tell me a bit about it and what it hopes to do?
Sure. Well, Kathy reached out to us. The Quilts on Barns Trail has a road rally every fall, and they were hoping to create an online interactive map that users could find the barns more easily with. And so we spoke with her about her goals for the project. And with my background as an anthropologist, as well as a geographer, we talked about going a little bit deeper with it and really telling the stories behind the barns and their owners and the farming heritage of Racine County. So that's sort of what the project morphed into, like a story-driven narrative map of these barn quilts in Racine County.
What are some of these stories that you've learned so far?
Oh boy, there's so many of them. I think we were able to do a tour of some of the barns, which our photographer Laura Mason came on the tour with us. And we were able to see, a working barn that still has cows and, grain silos and things like that, which not all of them are still active barns. And, we were able to see this date stone from the 1800s, and this family has been continually farming for 7 generations, and to just feel their pride in the continuation of that tradition was really amazing. And I think Kathy could talk more about Jean Jacobson, who also was one of the first barns on the trail.
Well, it was really interesting when we first started doing the project. We, Pat Levine and I, went to all the barn owners and got lots of different information. And the barn owners were very interested in talking to us and telling us the story about different things. There's one barn that's actually on an Indian trail. And so they have a pattern on their barn called Indian Trail. And each barn owner had a story. Some of them still use their barn. Some of them don't use their barn. Some of them are just used for storage. Some of them still have agriculture going on in their barn, but they're all very, very proud of their barn. So to know that we were even thinking about putting this in our county was very exciting to them, because it gave new energy to them thinking about their barn and their neighbors. And it turned out that all the neighbors knew each other. All these farmers that are out in the county, they really do all know each other. They're all connected by all kinds of things, family stories, barn stories, agricultural stories. And so it just began, and it began to create this amazing excitement of not only, once again, the farms and the agriculture in Racine County, but then the families and the barns and everything else that goes on around that.
Well, and that gets to this larger ideological question that we're asking ourselves in the state. So many farmers in Wisconsin have been struggling over the last decade, especially as things are shifting inside of their industry. What does this barn quilt project mean as we look at the legacy of farmers in the state of Wisconsin?
I think one of the most interesting things I learned in this process was, how a lot of these barns were built in a different time in farming, when, you could just contain a few animals that you had, and that would be enough to sustain the farm. And now, since farming, in order to become, a successful farmer in this sort of corporate industrial agricultural economy, you have to get big or get gone, is the thing we heard over and over again. And so some people told us that the barns, maybe some of them are no longer used for animals, and that actually leads to them just sort of degrading over time, because the animals sort of increase the humidity in the barn and keep the wood from disintegrating. But once it's no longer in active use, that's why, this sort of this important heritage of farming that's represented in these barns is slowly sort of decaying in a lot of places, unfortunately. So I think the barn is a really important point of pride in that farming heritage.
I think it was interesting as well that some of our students who were on the field trip, this was their first experience actually on a farm, and getting to see the working equipment and how large it was, and being next to the animals. And so this was really their first real connection with a farm, and being able to learn some of the stories behind it and what is involved with it, I think was interesting to them.
Yeah,
sure. Well, thank you all so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Caitlin Curtis is an assistant professor of geography and anthropology at UW-Parkside. Laura Mason is the creative services director at UW-Parkside. And Kathy Wilson is the executive director of the Racine Arts Council. They joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2022. Coming up next, we'll speak with the director of Richland, a film that explores what was left behind in a small town created during the Manhattan Project, and how the people living there today acknowledge that history. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Last year, the film Oppenheimer captivated millions, but that was the Hollywood version of the atom bomb's history. A documentary film takes a step back and offers a more complex look. During the Manhattan Project, the U.S. government built a small town in support of the Hanford nuclear site, where workers manufactured weapons-grade plutonium. It's a history that has shaped Richland's identity. In her film, director Eileen Lustig explores what it means for a town to take pride in such a violent heritage and how residents are grappling with its legacy today. Lustig speaks with WUWM's Lena Tran.
How did your work start on this project? What drew you to Richland's story?
Yeah, you know, I actually learned about Richland in a pretty roundabout and not intentional way. I was working between maybe 2015 and 2017, I was shooting this totally different film called Yours in Sisterhood, where I was doing these really massive road trips all over the US. And that film was based on letters that had been sent to Ms. Magazine in the 70s. So totally different topic. But I was basically finding letters and traveling to the communities where letters had been sent from in the 70s. And so I pretty accidentally had found a letter that was sent from Richland in the 70s to Ms. and then ended up in Richland for 24 hours and did some shooting there. And yeah, I think just got really kind of obsessed just from the one pretty short visit. I hadn't heard about Hanford. And it's interesting, as I've screened the film around the country, I find that people in the Pacific Northwest may have heard of Hanford, and then it's quite invisible still to the rest of the country. Which is interesting. Like Los Alamos is a site that people know much better. And Richland was Hanford was much larger. It was 600 square miles. It was really the largest kind of scaled up production site of the Manhattan Project, but it's pretty off people's radars still. And yeah, I think I just became so, you know, initially so curious and interested about what it meant for a community to have this kind of such a visible kind of nuclear weapon as a heritage symbol. But then also in that moment of like 2015, 2016, when I first went there, as the Trump election was happening, as all of these new forms of kind of US conservatism were becoming more and more visible, I think I just had a kind of intuition that in this community, it could be a place where I could think through kind of much bigger questions of how we live with our histories, what we look at, what we turn away from. So kind of all of the bigger questions of the films were things I was thinking about in that time.
But that complexity became pretty apparent to you from that first day you spent there?
In the town, yes, because really there's a way, anyone who comes into the town, there's this just kind of incredibly visible layer of kind of just visual nuclear heritage where there's, you know, restaurants and bowling alleys. And as you see in the film, kind of street names, like it's really everywhere visually in the town. So it's, yeah, I think it really felt like just a big question kind of hanging over the town of what is this relationship to history? What does it mean? What does it mean to value and cherish these really kind of violent symbols? The complexity, I think, felt really kind of on the surface to me right away.
Yeah. That being said, there aren't really easy answers in Richland. Like, did America do the right thing or the wrong thing? Or did the government mistreat the people who worked for the government? Or did they have good family supporting jobs? You know, why was that tone important to you?
Yeah, you know, I have actually watched a lot of nuclear films as I researched this film and as I was working on it. And I will say I feel there's very few nuclear films that are not advocacy films that are taking a really clear stance that's either pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear. And I think it's an issue where actually it produces such a divisive politics that it's actually hard to like hold a conversation at all where there's kind of complexity and recognition of what different people are holding kind of around their own experiences and lives in nuclear communities. So yeah, I think I knew from the beginning that I was not interested in making a kind of position film. But really my questions were, and I always start with questions, but I think I really wanted to think pretty deeply about what are the structural forces that are shaping conservative politics. And to me, a lot of the answers to that are in this kind of complexity of how do you reckon with work that's good work, that puts food on the table, that supports your family, and then what's the kind of storytelling you need to do to not feel horrible about your life and what you do for a living. So whether that's kind of attaching to really like patriotic national narratives, whether that's attaching to a kind of conservative set of national discourses or policies, whether that's just, you know, not wanting to think about nuclear harm either within your own community or to Japanese communities or indigenous communities or downwinder communities. I think to me, what I was really interested in was that question of what is the structure of that? And then how does that shape our politics? And that's it's a different starting point, I think, from kind of starting with, you know, nuclear weapons are horrible and have caused harm, or nuclear energy is great and is going to solve our, you know, energy transition crisis.
It's almost more challenging because it's like, oh, I'm used to engaging with nuclear stories where there is a clear position. And I'm thinking about this in a big election year again. You know, you mentioned that this project kind of started in a big election season. And maybe there is like a desire or need to understand people and perspectives that maybe differ from our own. What did you learn about having those difficult conversations?
Yeah, I mean, that was the whole project for me, honestly. Like, I really wanted to actually challenge myself to do that kind of listening that's generous, that's not judgmental, that's kind of making space for holding people's positions with complexity, to like letting people talk for long enough that you actually understand their position in a complicated way rather than like reducing them to a simple position, which I think is often what can happen in a more kind of advocacy oriented sort of talking heads documentary, is people just appear briefly to like represent a position, but they're not kind of holding all the complexity of who they are and what shaped their opinions.
Well, so you use art in really powerful ways in this film. There's these songs, the chorus, poetry readings. I loved the music performance with the two women. And then, of course, there's this really ghostly, beautiful sculpture from the Japanese artist. Do you feel like you were making a case that art is necessary for navigating these histories? Or did you feel like the community was already doing that and then you're just chronicling it?
I think it was both. And actually, whether, you know, the choral piece was already happening in the community, and then other things happened because I instigated them or kind of created collaborative spaces. But yeah, absolutely. I think there's something very powerful. And I think about this a lot, even in terms of my own work as a filmmaker, kind of what is it that a film can do or hold that's different from, you know, what a journalist can do with writing or what you might put in a scholarly book. And I think film is really something that can hold feelings and hold things that exceed language, or maybe are things that are hard to articulate verbally, like what it feels like to be somewhere or what someone's face and body language looks like while they're speaking. I think there's all of this kind of subtext and other information that's a little bit beyond what we can articulate consciously. And I think that's why I work in film, is because it can hold all of this other stuff that's not just information. And yeah, I think in the community and with processing these things that are difficult histories, I do feel like art can kind of hold community feelings in a way that's, yeah, way beyond what people might be able to talk about in an interview, but that's really deep and complicated.
Well, it's hard to ignore that your film released when the country was totally swept up in like Barbenheimer fever. Was that just like lucky press for you?
Mm-hmm. It was lucky press for me. Yeah, and it's been interesting. Of course, I had to go see Oppenheimer for research, and people have asked me about it a lot at screenings. I didn't know it was coming out. And of course, it's interesting to think across the two films. They're really, not only different in scale and budget, but I think also in kind of investments and approach and method. They're pretty different.
Well, what do you hope Richland adds to the conversation?
Yeah, you know, a lot, actually. I think Oppenheimer, you know, like a lot of Hollywood films, it's a kind of way of thinking about history that's through, you know, like one great white man who shaped history. And I think as someone who identifies as a feminist maker, I'm always also interested in thinking about history, but in a much more kind of networked and relational and complicated way, where history is never made by one great man, but it's something that happens across so many different spaces and stakeholders and impacts so many different people in different ways. And like, to me, to really think about history, it's about really important to think about kind of small everyday histories and all of the ways that those histories kind of overlap with each other or contradict each other. Yeah, I think it's just a really different set of methods. But then in that different set of methods, I think it's really important to, you know, hold those stories of what happened with Indigenous land dispossession when all of the Manhattan Project sites were built, what happened with downwinders in the community when nuclear weapons were, you know, detonated on U.S. land, what happened in Japan. I think it's really, yeah, just important to think expansively about who's affected by history. Mm-hmm. And I think Oppenheimer, that's just not its project to really sure. touch on all of those different spaces, but a lot of that is left out of the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Irene, for joining me on Lake Effect. It was really a pleasure to learn more about the film. I hope that Milwaukee viewers who are excited to see Oppenheimer will show up for Richland.
Thank you so much.
Irene Lustig is the director of the film Richland. She spoke with WUWM's Lena Tran, and Richland is now streaming on Apple TV+. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations or you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at Keith Posley's tenure as the superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools after his resignation. We'll also explore the politics of education in the Milwaukee area. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.